This is the second day of this October 2009 7-day session. We'll resume reading from our text from yesterday, a book called Bankei Zen, edited by Peter Haskell. And these this is a translated translations from the record of the 17th century Japanese Zen master Bankei. Yesterday we covered the high points of his biography, and now we'll start right in with the actual discourses, his own words. Just to set the scene here, this was in this is in 1690 when Bankei was 58. He conducted the most famous of his training periods. In Japan they call an ango, that was attended by nearly 1,700 monks of every Buddhist sect. Available space in the meditation hall was quickly exhausted, and a temporary zendo had to be improvised to accommodate the flood of new arrivals. The crowd of monks grew so immense, I'm reading here from the introduction, the editor's introduction, that the brothers who sponsored, funded this big gathering, panicked and begged Bankei to turn away any further applicants, but he wouldn't do so. And this gathering proved a success and was marred only by the tragic death of Bankei's close disciple, Soen. And during this gathering, he delivered a total of 60 lectures, many of which were recorded by members of the audience, people who were there. And these constitute the bulk of this book and the bulk of his surviving teachings. And then in the record itself, it said there were 1,683 monks listed in the temple register. This was a winter meeting. Those who attended included not only Soto and Rinzai followers, but members of the Ritsu, that's a Japanese word for the Vinaya, the Ritsu, the Shingon, the Tendai, the Pure Land, the True Pure Land, and the Nichiren schools, with laymen and monks mingled together, thronging around the lecture seat. This would definitely signal that it is a Mahayana Buddhist gathering when you have the laymen and monks together, Theravada gathering. The Buddhism of Southeast Asia would separate laymen and monks. So at that time, the master mounted the lecture seat and addressed the assembly, saying, "We've got a big crowd of both monks and laymen here at this meeting, and I thought I'd tell you about how, when I was young, I struck on the realization that the mind is unborn." This part about the mind, though, is something secondary. You monks, when you abide only in the unborn, will find that in the unborn, there's nothing anyone needs to tell you, nothing you need to hear. Because the Buddha mind is unborn and marvelously illuminating, it gets easily turned into whatever comes along. So as long as I'm telling the lay people here not to change themselves into these different things that come their way and trade their Buddha mind for thoughts, you monks may as well listen to. The master went on, among all you people here today, there's not a single one who is an unenlightened being. This is just how the Hakuin chant begins. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. Buddha means enlightened, endowed with enlightened awareness. All beings, no exceptions. Everyone here is a Buddha, Bankei continues. So listen carefully. What you all have from your parents innately is the unborn Buddha mind alone. There's nothing else you have innately. This Buddha mind you have from your parents innately is truly unborn and marvelously illuminating. That which is unborn is the Buddha mind. The Buddha mind is unborn and marvelously illuminating. And what's more, with this unborn, everything is perfectly managed. The actual proof of this unborn, which perfectly manages everything, is that as you're all turned this way listening to me talk, if out back there's the cawing of crows, the chirping of sparrows, or the rustling of the wind, or we could say the sound of the train, even though you're not deliberately trying to hear each of these sounds, you recognize and distinguish each one. The voices of the crows and sparrows, the rustling of the wind, you hear them without making any mistake about them, and that's what's called hearing with the unborn. In this way, all things are perfectly managed with the unborn. So here we have the premise, the basis of Bankei's original teaching. Is this use of the word unborn. It actually originated, the first use of that was in a sutra, at least one sutra, which was the Lankavatara Sutra. The Lankavatara Sutra was the one that reportedly was Bodhidharma's favorite sutra. But here Bankei makes it his own. Let's see if we can appreciate the meaning of this unborn. Unborn is just a way to refer to that which is beyond birth and death, that which is beyond arising and disappearing, that which is beyond form and change, time and space. I always go to my favorite analogy, which is the sky, where on a typical day, at least in Rochester, you've got the clouds, and the clouds come and go, of course. They change form. They move across the sky, change color sometimes. But behind all that change, there's just the original background. There's just the blue sky, or at night, the black sky. And that doesn't change. And it didn't, for the purposes of this analogy, it didn't originate either. It's just there. It didn't arise the way clouds arise, and doesn't disappear the way clouds disappear. It's the ground on which the clouds are the figure. This is a terminology that's used in psychological studies where you have in any, say, a picture, you've got the figure and the ground. The figure, of course, is the figure, the form, the face or the tree or whatever, and then the ground is that which is in the back. And of course you can't, there would be no figure as such without the ground. There would be no form, there would be no phenomena without emptiness. And Bhagya here is urging us to not get caught up in the form, the clouds, the faces, the stuff, the phenomena of our lives, but to see it as see it against the background of this, what is unborn and undying. We'll say more about it as we go on, because he continues to use this phrase. This is the most important word in his teaching. He goes on, well then, while you're all turned this way, listening to me talk, you don't mistake the chirp of a sparrow out back for the caw of a crow, the sound of a gong for that of a drum, a man's voice for a woman's, an adult's voice for a child's. You clearly recognize and distinguish each sound you hear without making any mistake. That's the marvelously illuminating dynamic function. It's none other than the Buddha mind, unborn and marvelously illuminating, the actual proof of the marvelously illuminating nature of the Buddha mind. Wondering, what's Bhagya telling us? Remember, he's addressing 1,700 people. What's Bhagya telling us? All of you are turned this way, intent only on hearing what I'm saying. No one's deliberately trying to hear the various sounds coming from out back. That's why, when all of a sudden these sounds appear, and you recognize and distinguish them, hearing them without any mistake, you're hearing with the unborn Buddha mind. Nobody here can claim he heard these sounds because he'd made up his mind beforehand to listen for them when they were made. So, in fact, you're listening with the unborn. In broader terms, we can say our ability to perceive phenomena of any kind, visually, auditorily, our ability to perceive with any of the senses, and to think, that's the sixth sense in Buddhism, the five ordinary senses, and the sixth is the sense of thinking or thought. Our very ability to do that is determined by our abiding in the other half, the other side of it. The opposite of phenomenon is noumenon, to use very philosophical language. There can be no discriminating except from a basis of abiding in that which is beyond discrimination. The two are mutually conditioning. You can't see a form on a piece of paper unless there is the background. It sounds terribly logical, but this is very important, because as most people never infer the other side, the noumenon, the emptiness side, the unconditioned, the unborn. There's just this this involvement always in phenomena, but the phenomena wouldn't be there, we couldn't be aware of them without that which is other than phenomena, the blue sky behind the clouds. This is why it is when one has a first insight into no mind that one can for the first time truly and most effectively perceive the nature of mind, the stuff of the mind. This is why late in Sesshin, when the mind is relatively empty, everyone's mind is relatively empty late in Sesshin, then the workings of the mind, the thoughts, the memories, the whatever floats up into consciousness is so conspicuous by contrast. It's so clear. We're much quicker to notice stuff in the mind when the mind is empty. He goes on, everyone who conclusively realizes that what is unborn and marvelously illuminating is truly the Buddha mind, abiding in the unborn Buddha mind, is a living Tathagata from today, forever after, a living Buddha. Even Buddha, he says, is just a name given to traces that have arisen. So from the standpoint of the unborn, it's only a secondary matter, a peripheral concern. The person of the unborn abides at the source of all Buddhas. That which is unborn is the source of all things, the starting point of all things. There's nothing more original than the unborn, nothing prior to it. So he's telling the monks that as soon as we use words, that's just once removed from the thing itself. Words are forms; they are in the world of form, and so even the word Buddha, or enlightenment, or even the word unborn itself, strictly speaking, is once removed from the reality that is this unborn Buddha mind. We can still use the word. We use these words, Buddha and unborn, and so forth, but it should never be taken for the thing itself. It's the finger pointing to the moon. It's not the moon. There's no question of perishing here. So when you abide in the unborn, it's superfluous to speak about the imperishable too. That's the reason I only talk about the unborn and don't mention the imperishable. What isn't created can't be destroyed. So since it's unborn, it's obvious it's imperishable without having to mention it. Isn't that so? Yeah, he could just as easily have, instead of using the word unborn through his teaching, say the undying. There is some repetition in these talks of his. I try to cut out some of the repetition, but repetition is a long-standing teaching device that was used by the Buddha himself to hammer in the important points of the teaching. He goes on, when you abide in the unborn, you're abiding at the source of all things. What the Buddhas of the past realized was the unborn Buddha mind, and what Buddhas in the future will realize is the unborn Buddha mind too. We today are living in the degenerate age of Buddhism. Yet when there's even one person who abides in the unborn, the true teaching has been restored to the world. All of you, Isn't it so? It certainly is. When you've conclusively realized this, then and there you'll open the eye that sees into people's minds, and that's why my school is called the Clear-Eyed School. When the eye that sees into people is manifested, whenever it happens to be, that moment is the complete realization of the Dharma. I want you to know this. Whoever you may be, at that moment, you are my heir. When he says, when you abide in the unborn, you're abiding at the source of all things. To put this into terms of our meditation practice, just so there is no more confusion about this, abiding in the unborn means abiding in no mind, which is a mind beyond attachment to thoughts. The breath, when we are absorbed in the breath, we are absorbed in the unborn. When we're absorbed in mu, beyond thought, this is abiding in the unborn. Same with any koan. The each practice, breath practice or koan, its whole point is to deliver us from enmeshment in our thoughts, to help us see the blue sky that's behind the clouds. So we don't need to bring in a new concept to think about this unborn. It's really abiding in our practice that we're working on, especially to the extent that it is beyond any grasping at thoughts, pursuing thoughts, attachment to thoughts. The thoughts still come. The clouds still cross the sky. It doesn't have anything to do with the background. It's when we get caught up in the clouds and the thoughts and the emotional states, the passing phenomena, that's when we cease to have the freedom of the unborn. That is the no mind. His talks here are divided into little segments, of course, because nothing written in the last 30 years would be read if it weren't divided into little bite-sized pieces. A certain teacher of Buddhism told me, instead of teaching the same old thing in your talks day after day, you ought to throw in a few Buddhist miracle stories once in a while and give people a refreshing change of pace. And then he comments, of course, he could be right. I may be thick-headed, but provided something is really helpful to people, then, thick-headed or not, I'm not beyond memorizing one or two old stories if I put my mind to it. However, teaching this sort of thing is like feeding poison to sentient beings, and feeding people poison is something I certainly can't do. Well, as you all know, we don't have any use for miracle stories in Zen, and neither does Bankei. Another talk, he said, what everyone has from his parents innately is the Buddha mind alone. But since your parents themselves fail to realize this, you become deluded too, and then display this delusion in raising your own children. Everyone involved in bringing up children, he mentions nursemaids and babysitters, display every sort of deluded behavior, including stupidity, selfish desire, and the anger of fighting demons. Growing up with deluded people surrounding them, children develop a first-rate set of bad habits, becoming quite proficient at being deluded themselves and turning into unenlightened beings. Originally, when you're born, you're without delusion. But on account of the faults of the people who raise you, someone abiding in the Buddha mind is turned into a first-rate, unenlightened being. This is something I'm sure you all know from your own experience. Your parents didn't give you any delusions whatever when you were born. No bad habits, no selfish desires. But afterward, once you'd come into the world, you picked up all different sorts of delusions, which then developed into bad habits, so that you couldn't help becoming deluded. That which you didn't pick up from outside is the unborn Buddha mind, and here no delusions exist. Since the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, you're able to learn things, even to the point of thoroughly learning all sorts of deluded behavior. At the same time, since it's marvelously illuminating, when you hear this, you'll resolve not to be deluded, and from today on, cease creating delusion, abiding in the unborn Buddha mind as it is. Just as before, you applied yourself skillfully to picking up delusions and made yourself deluded, now you use the same skill to listen to this and stop being deluded. That's what a splendid thing the Buddha mind is. So he's speaking of the what is in the text is sometimes called the mirror-like quality of this Buddha mind that reflects everything as it is without itself having any form, without any characteristics of its own. Listen and you'll realize the preciousness of Buddha mind. Then, since there's nothing that can take the place of this precious Buddha mind, even if you want to be deluded, you won't be able to be anymore. So, of course, here he's talking about what in more contemporary psychological terms we would call our conditioning. That because of our, what is sometimes called in the text, our false conditioning of the mind, we acquire these habit patterns of various forms of greed and hostility and delusion, confusion. We pick these up through the socialization process at home and through the education, through our exposure to all kinds of influences from our peers. And these things become entrenched in the mind, and then they start to acquire a life of their own. But behind this false conditioning, behind all these habit forces, there still remains shining clearly this unborn mind that existed before ever there was any conditioning. It's because you don't realize the preciousness of Buddha mind that you indulge in self-centeredness, creating delusions that do you harm. Yet those delusions are so precious to you that all of you actually want to become deluded, even at the risk of your own life. Foolish, isn't it? Unable to withstand the base impulses produced by your selfish desires, you become deluded. With all delusions, it's the same. Well, any person who has ever reflected for a few seconds about the condition of their mind, their character, will understand what he's saying here when he says those delusions are so precious to you that all of you actually want to become deluded. It's perverse, isn't it? That we cling to our delusions. We see ourselves reacting out of our habits, reacting to people, getting into quarrels, getting into selfish, grasping behavior, egoistic, all the thousands of kinds of egoistic behavior, and yet there's some kind of perverse comfort in that. And yet it always, in the end, bites us back. These things that we cling to, it diminishes our lives. It impinges on our well-being, our happiness, our peace of mind. It contaminates our lives, our minds. He goes on, everyone insists that the way he likes to behave is his innate character, so he can't do anything about it. He'll never tell you how, actually, he indulges in self-centeredness because of his selfish desires, holding on to those kinds of behavior he likes. Instead, he tries to sound clever and talk about how it's all innate. To falsely accuse your own parents of something you never got from them is terribly unfilial. Remember, this is a Confucian culture, Japan, as China and Korea. So this would be a real indictment to his listeners, for him to call them unfilial. Is there anyone who's born a drunkard, a gambler, or a thief, who's born with any sort of vice? No one's born that way. Once you pick up a taste for liquor, it promptly develops into a drinking habit. And then, because of selfish desire, you find yourself unable to stop. Without realizing, you've become deluded. It's only foolishness, so you've no cause to claim it's innate and pass off the blame on your parents. Well, I have to interject here that there is a body of research that is quite widely accepted that we do inherit from our parents certain tendencies. We are, to some degree, genetically determined. It's not just our faces and our bodies, but it is other things. Nonetheless, his point is, yeah, we all have some genetic challenges, either physical or emotional, but at the same time, we do, moment by moment, have a degree of freedom where we can choose whether to give way to those propensities and just sort of default into that part of our disposition that is genetically influenced or not. He certainly recognizes how self-defeating it is to just lay responsibility for our problems on our parents. It doesn't make any sense. Our parents themselves could lay the responsibility for their defilements on their parents and so forth. So where does it stop? It stops here, doesn't it? It stops here. A layman presented himself for private instruction with the master and asked, when one is enlightened like your reverence, do the three worlds really appear as if they were glimpsed in the palm of the hand? The three worlds is usually refers to the world of form, the world of form, the world of formlessness, the world of form without desire, and the world of desire. It's just a way of designating all conceivable realms of existence. That sometimes it refers to, the three worlds refers to past, present, and future, and that's what it means here, according to the inserted the little explanation inserted in brackets. So when one is enlightened, do the three worlds really appear as if they were glimpsed in the palm of the hand? The master said, what you asked me just now was whether, when one is enlightened like myself, the three worlds appear as if glimpsed in the palm of the hand. Is that correct? The layman said, it is. The master said, is that question something you've been thinking over? Or is it something that suddenly occurred to you just now to ask? The layman said, well, I didn't really form this question on the spur of the moment, but as I've been mulling it over and just happened to think of it now, I asked you about it. The master told him, in that case, you needn't bother asking about my affairs. Your wanting to see the three worlds can wait. First, thoroughly examine your own self. What's really essential right here and now. Until you've examined your own self, however much I tell you about how things look to me, you won't be recognizing it, seeing it, or settling it for yourself, so you won't be convinced. And even if you did believe it, you still wouldn't be proving my words. Since you won't have seen the three worlds for yourself, it won't be of any use to you. This is a sign of a good teacher, when they just turn away these questions that are really peripheral. The monk is avoiding himself. He's avoiding himself by coming up with this question, asking about these realms that he doesn't really recognize as his own mind. He's avoiding his own mind. He's really avoiding the three worlds in talking about them. And that's Bonke's point in addressing him here. You needn't bother about asking about my affairs. First, thoroughly examine your own self. When you thoroughly examine your own self, you'll know for yourself both the visible and invisible. There won't be any need for me to tell you or for you to ask me. Without first of all thoroughly examining your own self, what's really essential right here and now, you come asking me extraneous questions about whether or not the three worlds can be seen, all of which can easily wait. It's just getting sidetracked, going off on a tangent. It's all irrelevant to you. like counting up my money for me without having even half a cent of your own. The most practitioners are always ready to find some way to dodge the matter itself, to flee into the extraneous, to come up with questions that aren't the real question. Because to face oneself, to face the real question, whatever it may be for you, this takes real courage. It puts us in a place that is unfamiliar to us, that is unknown to us. It leads us into the unknown. And most people are uncomfortable entering the unknown, entering the dark. And so people come up with all kinds of things. This happens all the time in Doksan, where people find things to bring to Doksan that aren't really essential. People come and sometimes report on what happened in the sitting earlier in the morning. Well, this morning it went pretty well. I went through a pretty good period. There weren't that many thoughts. There was some pain, but there weren't that many thoughts. But then I started thinking about this and that. You know, I let people do this for a while as a way to help them come see me in Doksan, so we can have some starting point to start talking together and get something going. But it's not really to the point, is it? Talking about little things about this and that happened earlier in the day or last night. Now, if there's something that has happened that really threw you for a loop, that you're still concerned about, or something that caused fear or anxiety, and you're wondering about it and you're not sure how to proceed, of course, it's fine to bring that up. But just to report on these little dinky differences in this round from that round, this is not a good use of your time, your attention. It's not a good use of your attention to attend to these little variations in your sitting that just will go on changing. That's what this guy is doing, trumping up this question about the three worlds. He's done some reading, and he's composed a question that he thinks will be show him as being thoughtful or intelligent or whatever. Bhante won't have anything of it. His job is to keep turning people back to face themselves, which always means now. Facing yourself means being present, looking at what's now happening. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.